Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, February 3rd, 2021. Producing from his home studio in the snowed-in foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working for my snowed-in home office in New York. Wow, Taylor, we had another inch and a half of snow here in New York last night. That means that at my home, it's about 18 and a half, 19 inches. Had 7 passes with a snowblower, different times. You, I'm sure, were doing the same thing.
Not quite. We got about 13 inches or so. It didn't snow again here, just lightly this morning, but they take care of that in my neighborhood, the snow blowing. So,
but you didn't go out with a just shovel in hand and say, look, I have to get outside and help you people?
No, I shoveled like a 3-foot square on my deck so I could measure how much snow there was. That was it. But the community was nice enough to blow the snow at 1:45 in the morning on Monday. So that was tough, but I'll take it. It beats physical labor.
They were doing that and trying to wake you up because they were bitter that they were out there and you were not.
Totally.
So I can understand that. And I like that. Taking the little square of snow, kind of like cutting a piece of cake, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And just to see how deep it went. I think a lot of people were doing that because we got so much snow. Today, we'll be talking with Jeff Passan about his excellent E60 feature about Drew Robinson, who survived a suicide attempt despite shooting himself in the temple. We'll be talking with Sarah Langs of MLB.com and with Derek Gould of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch about the Cardinals' acquisition of Nolan Arenado. First, some news and notes. The Angels yesterday suspended pitching coach Mickey Callaway after reported sexual harassment, that according to The Athletic. Mickey Callaway has told the Angels that he is innocent. He's essentially claimed his innocence, and the Angels have suspended him as they go through the investigation. Major League Baseball also investigating the situation. The St. Louis Cardinals acquired third baseman Nolan Arenado from the Colorado Rockies. Here was Nolan yesterday speaking with reporters covering the team.
I'm thrilled. You know, I'm very excited to join this team. You know, it's a bittersweet moment, right? You know, I'm going to miss some of the boys on the Rockies. You know, I got to know them. Got to know some of those coaches for a long time. And I've known a lot of them since I was like 18 years old, you know, and I'm 29 now. So, you know, I have some relationships that I'll cherish for the rest of my life over there. But coming to a team like St. Louis with great players and great history, it was, you know, I'm just super excited. I've always admired this organization from afar. You know, I told Mo the story when I was a rookie. We went to St. Louis and I remember Tulo was just the first thing he told me when we got there. Is like, just watch the way these guys play the game and you're going to learn, or you're going to learn something. And he was quite right about that, because this team was extremely talented and they did the little things to win ball games. And that's something that I've always admired about this organization.
So happy and exciting times in St. Louis. Not so in Colorado. Yesterday, Jeff Breidich and owner Dick Montfort held a Zoom call with reporters. Montfort indicated he was frustrated by the Arenado trade, but he said the team is built to compete. His quote, I'm a fan. I truly am. I understand how the fans feel. To be quite honest, I would probably feel the same way. I do even feel the same way. When we signed Nolan, it was an attempt to keep Nolan for the rest of his career, but things do change. I don't understand this trade. I'm going to be talking with Jeff Passan about the Rockies' decisions as they went through this. The Cardinals, by the way, also retained over the weekend Adam Wainwright, Yadier Molina. Chris Archer is returning the Tampa Bay Rays on a 1-year, $6.5 million deal. Nelson Cruz going back to the Minnesota Twins like everybody thought that eventually he would. Didi Gregorius got 2 years and $28 million with the Philadelphia Phillies to be their shortstop. Sean Doolittle, the respected reliever, has signed with the Cincinnati Reds on a 1-year contract. And in recent days, we've heard about Danny Murphy retiring after 12 seasons in the big leagues. He was a 3-time All-Star and had a career 296 average. And earlier this week, Red Sox second baseman Dustin Pedroia announced his retirement. Here's Dustin.
My children have been through, and my wife have been through a lot. You know, they've seen me through 6 surgeries, they've seen me through a lot. And, you know, I was having a tough time up until, you know, my middle son, Cole, that they wanted me to coach his baseball team. And I think, sorry for getting a little choked up, but that got me through the next step of understanding that, hey, there's something else I'm going to be able to do. And I'm good at it. You know, I coaching the kids and just telling them I think they were happy that they get their dad to be home all the time. They need me. So but my biggest thing in my mind was, this could be my last game. You don't know. And that's the way I approached it from Little League on.
Now, there probably were more stories about Dustin Pedroia than any player during his time in baseball. My favorite, Taylor, I don't know if you've ever heard this story. Dustin, of course, played at Arizona State. Barry Bonds played at Arizona State. And Dustin Pedroia, during his time at Arizona State, surpassed some of the records that were left behind by Barry Bonds. So fast forward to Dustin's first year in the big leagues, and they happen to play the Giants in Fenway Park. And Barry Bonds gets to second base, and here comes little Dustin Pedroia, rookie, going over to second base, and he looks at Bonds and goes, "Hey, man, sorry about all your records."
That's amazing. I heard a good one yesterday. He told about David Ortiz not knowing his first name for like 10 years. That was incredible.
Yeah, Dustin, he was awesome. I do hope he continues to have some role in baseball because baseball needs folks like him. Before we get to Derek Gould, to Jeff Passan and to Sarah Langs, two things I want to mention. First, the latest 30 for 30, Al Davis versus the NFL, premieres February 4th at 9 p.m. Eastern time on ESPN. I can't wait for that. Immediately following its debut, check out the Jalen and Jacoby, the After Show podcast, where the guys will be joined by director Ken Rogers. Listen and subscribe to Jalen and Jacoby, the After Show, wherever you get your podcast. And it's Super Bowl week. Couldn't be a better time to listen to Super Bowl champion Keyshawn Johnson, Jay Williams, and Zubin Mehente weekday mornings on ESPN Radio, 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern, or search for, download, and subscribe to Keyshawn, Jay Will, and Zubin, wherever you get your podcasts.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live.
Jeff Passan covers baseball for ESPN. Of course, Jeff, great story on Drew Robinson. We said at the top of the podcast, congratulations on that. You must have gotten a ton of feedback from people.
It was really cool. And you know, you never know what the response to a story is going to be. And actually, the day before the story ran, I was sitting in line waiting to pick up my kid at school and called Drew to walk through the possibilities of what the day was going to be like. I said, there's a chance that, you know, a few thousand people are going to read this and a couple of people are going to be affected by it. And maybe it's too long. Maybe it just, you know, maybe it doesn't resonate. Maybe something else happens that day. You can't get caught up in the reaction, but it was really difficult not to get caught up in the reaction because it was just so overwhelmingly positive. And I think the intent of Drew telling his story was to help people. And I honestly, within the first 24 hours of it being out there and of the documentary being out there as well, I think that he unquestionably has helped people and sees this clear path for his life right now where he's going to be able to do this for a really, really long time.
And I've got more questions. I got, you know, as someone who works in the business, I got questions about the process coming up. Before we dive into that, I do want to ask you about the labor situation in baseball. Of course, Major League Baseball last Friday presenting a proposal for the union for a 154-game schedule, spring training bump back, the players getting 100% compensation, the whole thing being tied to expanded playoffs, a universal DH. And I got to say, when I saw the proposal, and I thought, okay, well, looks like they're trying to step into the middle ground on this thing. And I thought that they would lead to more conversations and eventually an agreement, but that's not what we got. Where do the two sides stand now?
In a bad place, Buster. And, you know, during conversations I had that last day when the union rejected the proposal and didn't counter, and MLB essentially came out and said, all right, see you February 17th at spring training. As much as I was focused on that moment itself and those machinations and decisions, I had my eye ahead and I was asking people on both sides, should I be worried about December 1st? And the responses I got were, and I'm quoting verbatim here, hell yes, absolutely, I am. And these are people who are in prominent roles here. You know, these aren't backbenchers who are saying something like this. And I think what this portends is really problematic, because this is two in a row, Buster. I think you might have made an allusion to that, in fact, that this is last year, the March agreement. They couldn't agree what they'd agreed upon, or they couldn't agree upon what they had agreed upon. And this time, something that in theory makes a lot of sense. Let's push it back. It's mutually beneficial. And you can argue, and I think that the union would, that it's more beneficial for the league because they're going to be the ones who are making more money from this. They're going to be the ones who benefit from it. We're young, we're hearty and hale, we're healthy, we're going to be fine. We weathered all the COVID cases last year. And in a situation where there's more equanimity, where the sides respect one another, I think that the union would have looked at MLB trying to push back the season and said, we're going to be partners with you on this. There is no partnership anymore. They are true adversaries at this point, and that adversarial relationship cuts to the heart of this because Buster, I spoke with someone who has very good knowledge of the situation, and this is on the player side. And I said to him, strip out the expanded playoffs, strip out the universal DH, strip out every single thing except 162 games pay for 154 games played, and you push back the season 30 days. Does that deal happen? And the answer was no. And the answer was no because it was Major League Baseball coming to the union.
Right.
This is what the perspective is from the players. We're happy with the system right now. And it's funny that they're happy with a basic agreement that's just slaughtered them for years. But that notwithstanding, they're happy with the system now. And if the other side is going to come to us and ask for something, then we need something in return, and we did not feel like we were being properly compensated for it.
Just to be clear, too, your reference to December 1 is when the current CBA is set to expire, and there is an expectation in the industry that we're going to have some sort of a standoff in labor, strike, lockout, wherever we wind up with the thing. That seems to be the trajectory that we're on. You mentioned before that perspective of, well, you guys are going to benefit more than we are. I got to say that sort of thinking makes me like slam my head because I like last summer
when you are literally hitting your head right now, by the way.
I know.
Just for people who are listening here, Buster is hitting his head at this moment.
Because like last summer, I know the players felt really good. They stuck together. They got 100% salary for 60 games. And you know what? Because there was no negotiation, because there was no bartering, the free agents this winter have gotten destroyed. As we, you know, there are over 100 unsigned free agents as we stand here today. The numbers are coming down Sean Doolittle taking $1.4 million, like that number jumped out at me like, oh my God. So my question, and I've been asking a lot of people this, like, what is the big picture? We know that Major League Baseball really wants to get as much revenue as they can out of this year. They put the plan forward. They want to talk about expanded playoffs. You know, they want to move ahead. What is the big picture strategy for the union? In other words, what's the end game? That what are they really aiming for as we move forward into these next CBA talks?
I'm going to be fascinated to see what the answer is there, because
so you don't know it either. I don't know. In past years, in the 1990s, it was, you know, fighting against salary cap and revenue sharing and different things. I don't know what they're fighting for.
See, I think there are things, whether it's service time manipulation, whether it's I think the main narrative for the union is going to be competitiveness. And I think that's actually a really smart tack to take, at least publicly, and for the good of the game, too, honestly. I mean, a while ago, I didn't find an issue with tanking because I thought that it's a novel concept. It's gaming the system. The more time's gone on, though, I just look at any kind of anti-competitiveness as cancerous to the sport. And problematic in a number of different ways. And so I think different levers to bring competitive spirit back to the ownership side is going to be the MO here. What I meant though when I said I'm not exactly sure, we have to look at the history of labor relations in baseball to understand how the union got into power in the first place. It did not do so by marching in and fighting for everything it wants right now. It did so incrementally. It did so with a very, very long game being played. And it did so knowing that there is an inherent instability in Major League Baseball, which is that you have 30 teams that all want to beat each other. And that they band together for labor's sake, but in reality, there are fissures that are there that are exploitable because you, as the Players Association, you can be unanimous, you can be as one. And the strength that Marvin Miller and Donald Fehr really, really gave those players, really stressed to those players, is where they got that power to take those incremental steps. You know, instead of trying to take the entire apple in your mouth at once and choking on it, they took reasonable bites. And by the end of it, Major League Baseball was nothing but a little rotten core. Over the last 20 years, Buster, Major League Baseball has taken that same thing. We're not going to go for the full Monty here. Right. We're going to go and pick away here, and we're going to go pick away there, and we're going to go do this. And the way that they've chipped away at the union has been fascinating to see. So if the union tries to get everything accomplished in one fell swoop, it's primed to be a disaster. But I think that there is some leverage that they can use. And it was interesting to see you tweet, you know, the ball's in the union's court right now. How do they use it? They didn't, you know, or maybe their use amounted essentially to, hey, we're going to keep the expanded playoffs in our pocket and see exactly how much Major League Baseball really wants them.
See, I wonder too, my idea, and sorry, we're going to talk about Drew Robinson in a second. My idea, I thought about writing a piece about this, is that if I'm sitting in Major League Baseball shoes right now, I would go to them because the union is saying, look, we don't want to have to bargain universal DH because we know everybody wants it. We know Major League Baseball wants it. We know the team want it. Why should we pay for that? If I'm sitting in Major League Baseball's shoes now, I might go to the union and say, you know what? We're going to listen to you. You're right. We're going to give you universal DH, which would be great news in this moment for guys like Marcell Ozuna. We want expanded playoffs. Tell us what you want in return. We want expanded playoffs and make that announcement. We're going to have universal DH in 2021. We also want expanded playoffs. Tell us what you want. I'd be curious to see what the response would be.
See, the problem, though, at that point is, doesn't that just turn into a PR situation? Because you know the answer from the union's going to be no. Like, if that's the case, you're almost trying to bait them into looking bad publicly. But
while giving them the universal DH and basically conceding that spot to them, that point to them.
I was going to say, after Nelson Cruz signed, I mean, like, for Marcell Ozuna, it would be great. Don't get me wrong. But the rest of the market, I mean, that's the thing about the universal DH. The value on it for the union is not all that great now. It's just not. I mean, even let's say that Cruz hadn't signed with the Twins.
Yeah.
Let's say that the National League had been involved. How much more is he going to get than $13 million? A million or two? Right. Maybe three. And he's the best. Ozuna may get more than 1 year if there's a DH in the National League, but he might get that now too, because, you know, stick him in the outfield for a year and you know it's coming in 2022. Like, right. It's going to be part of baseball in 2022. The marginal value of the designated hitter for the union, I just don't think is all that great. So if MLB wants to do that, they probably should, because it's going to be a better game in 2021 with the DH and the NL and without pitchers who are already at great injury risk, trying to compound that with hitting as well.
Well, and maybe it'll be perceived as a peace offering, but probably not.
Nope.
The title of your piece on ESPN.com is "I'm Meant to Be Alive." I'm curious about how you began to pursue this piece, how you heard about his situation initially.
It pursued me a little bit, actually. I had heard, and this was not with a name attached to it, I had heard that there was a player who had attempted suicide and that he might want to talk. And I was surprised by that. You know, typically in situations like that, people are very private. And the fact that it was as soon after, it gave me reservations. And I was like, you know, let's reconnect a few months down the road. And this was a person who I've known in baseball for a long time now and who knew Drew as well. And, you know, Drew, from the beginning, Drew had this passion and this purpose. And you never know how real it is in the moment, because you never know exactly how the next few months are going to unfold as you get used to this new life after this horribly traumatic incident. But that part of things, sharing his story, inspiring people, helping them, it never changed. And he was ready to talk. And for, you know, we set up a call on FaceTime, and I had spoken with some experts on suicide beforehand, just to get some questions to ask to make sure that this is a story that we could pursue responsibly. Because, you know, you never want to put somebody who could be vulnerable in a situation that is bad for him. And that is one thing that we've tried to take enormous care in doing in this story, and in making sure that we're telling it not just so that the public can see Drew's story in a light that is helpful and that is not going to cause problem, going to bring up trauma, going to exacerbate other situations, but to do so for Drew too. I mean, this is his story, and we're just the conduit for him to get his message out to the world. And over time, I grew much more comfortable with where he was, with what he was saying, and in knowing that this is real and it's absolutely incredible.
What was that first conversation like with him, having, you know, heard about his injury? You know, knowing his background, but not really having gotten a chance to talk to him since he made the attempt.
I haven't asked him this. I think I probably need to, but I thought it was going to be a phone conversation, and he FaceTimed me. And I think he FaceTimed me because he wanted to see my reaction to him not having an eye. And I remember thinking to myself in that moment, it's a very shocking thing when you see him for the first time. And I remember saying to myself, don't let your face show what you're thinking inside, because I didn't want him to think that I was judging or that I was looking at him as anything other than what he is, which is a human being who went through something absolutely tragic and is trying to put back together his life and help people. And so whatever he looks like physically, it didn't matter to me. I wanted to hear what he was thinking. And, you know, he read me this reflection that he wrote about April 16th, the day that he had attempted to end his life. And sitting there and hearing in great detail what had happened, and the clarity with which he was telling it, and the poise that he had, and the purpose, I thought in that moment, if we ever get to tell this story, it will be the most impactful thing I can ever do professionally, because it was that compelling and that amazing from the start. And over the months since, I've only grown to respect and admire Drew even more.
And your story reflects that, all the detail. You know, I get asked, I'm sure you do too, about, you know, who's a favorite player I ever covered. And I always talk about Tony Gwynn, not only because he was incredibly smart, but he spoke anecdotally. And I thought of him as I was reading your piece, with the level of detail that Tony would always talk about hitting, and you talk about game experiences. It was like he was writing your story for you. And I'm reading the detail that Drew gave you, that his specific memories of what he was feeling when he first came to consciousness after the attempt. And I was like, wow, this person is not only, tremendously reflective, but wow, what a memory. You must have felt that way as you're having those conversations.
There are so many details that are, and we use the word unbelievable. No, this is like unbelievable. Yeah. It is impossible to believe. And I was not skeptical because I never found Drew to be a liar, a fabulist, somebody who would exaggerate things. Like, the story is already bonkers enough. You know, you don't need to embellish it all. But just the amount of detail he remembered was so stunning. I'm like, nah, this can't all be true. And then Martin Kotabashian, who was the director for the documentary, which, like, I love my story, I'm proud of it, but the movie's better. It's really good. And so I recommend, it's on ESPN Plus. I recommend everyone go read it, go watch it rather. Martin got the body cam footage from the police who came to the house after Drew had dialed 911. And there were a couple hours of footage, and we watched through the footage, and all the tiny details that Drew had remembered were showing up as these police officers were walking through the house. You know, they kick down the door. They're worried that it's an ambush because someone had called 911 and said, I shot myself in the head and I've been alive for 20 hours. Like, That doesn't seem real. Clearly, they're trying to get us out here to do something. So kick down the door, cops come in, guns drawn, and they have to canvass the house. And you see the laundry room off the garage, and there's blood exactly where Drew said. And you see the bathroom, and all, you know, we didn't include all the details of what was in there. They were... Right. They were graphic and honestly a little superfluous to the story, but everything matched up. And I was stunned. Maybe I shouldn't be, because Drew is capable, clearly, of doing some pretty amazing things. But to shoot oneself in the head, spend the next 20 hours in pain and trying to figure out if you want to live, and still have the ability to remember everything that happened, that is one of the things that I truly will never understand how. And, you know, I don't know if it is divine. I don't know if it's a miracle. I just know that it is. And I'm glad he's here.
Jeff, when I started your story, I began, you know, to have this sort of feeling inside, like, boy, I'm curious to see how they deal with the uncertainty, how Jeff deals with the uncertainty of the future. And sure enough, and I thought it was really important that you made it clear early in the story, this is not a happily ever after story, uh-huh. You know, and that was so important. Can you just tell me about your thought process as you went through that?
You have to, because there were many things that we were mindful of and cognizant of, but reporting on suicides and attempted suicides is a really, really tricky thing to do safely. And what we were trying to do the entire time was to balance telling Drew's story in the most compelling and relatable fashion, and also doing so in the most responsible way that we can. And the responsibility quite often ended up outweighing the compelling part. I mean, there are a lot of details that were in the first draft of the story that did not make it to the end. And Rachel Ulrich, the editor for the written story, is brilliant at what she does. And we got in touch with the people who literally wrote the guidelines on suicide reporting, and the someone from suicidology.org. We talked with survivors of suicide attempts. We talked with people who have had family members lost to suicide. I mean, we knew this was going to be the type of story that could really help people. We wanted to do our very best to make sure that it wasn't the type of story that was going to harm people too. And, you know, we took that really seriously from the start, because in the end, you know, our job is to do good, right? Our job is to be responsible, to be fair. But as much as anything, when you're writing on a subject like this, to look out for people, because that's what Drew wants to do. And this, in the end, is his story, and we're just the conduits through which he's telling it.
Well, you did a great job of it. Congratulations again. People can go and find, as Jeff said, the documentary on ESPN Plus, or you can go and read his story on ESPN.com. Jeff, thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Buster. Appreciate it.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes!
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Numbers Game.
Sarah Langsdale, a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, one of the reasons why I was surprised that there wasn't more back and forth and then eventually the players didn't agree to delay the start of spring training was, I thought, man, that extra month might have been really valuable for a lot of unsigned free agents. And, you know, I had an agent actually remind me, because he went through and counted all of them, how many players are still out there looking for jobs. You've got numbers on that.
Yeah, so based on what I looked at, I saw 144 free agents still out there right now. And with what happened with 2020, it is worth noting there could be a few more. I think that guys who didn't play in 2020 might have missed what I was looking at. But it certainly sounds like a lot. And I think that the pace that we've seen with this offseason so far sort of indicated it would have made sense to be a little bit more stretched out, definitely, to see all of these players eventually end up signed.
Yeah, and I heard a story about one team in particular that was interested in signing a couple of guys. And after word came down that there wasn't going to be a delay, which probably ensures that there are going to be more games with no fans played in the stands, the team basically shut down the front office. The ownership shut down the front office and said, no, you know what? Never mind. We're not going to have that extra revenue, so we're not going to sign those players. When Sean Doolittle yesterday signed, I think it was for $1.4 million, that really got my attention. I'm like, this guy is a respected veteran. He's got years in the big leagues. He's shown how good he can be. And for Sean Doolittle to wind up, I don't want to use the word settling. It sounds harsh, but that's the way it feels. For $1.4 million tells you potentially what's on the table for most of those 144 unsigned players.
Definitely. It's interesting. You know, it felt like we got a little bit of momentum right around when George Springer signed and when that deal was first reported. And it felt like some of the dominoes were starting to fall. But I think that whatever sand kind of went down the hourglass there then stopped. And now we're at this point where we're just sort of waiting again. And I guess Trevor Bauer is that next domino to potentially, lead to some more guys signing. But obviously, you know, with all of what we've seen going on in the last 2 days, teams are sending out press releases. You know, JetBlue Park is opening on February 17th and this park and that park for spring training. So it is very close to when these teams are going to start breaking camp or opening camp, I should say.
Yeah, the big name still on the board, Trevor Bauer, Jake Odorizzi among starting pitchers, Marcell Ozuna, who, of course, was so good for the Atlanta Braves last year, still also looking for a job. Okay, Nolan Arenado goes to the St. Louis Cardinals. What type of impact do you think he could have on the Cardinals?
I think he's going to have a huge impact. You know, I've been tracking these Fangraphs projected winning percentages. And I think I came on here 2 weeks ago and told you how there was no NL Central team projected to be above 500. And there still isn't. Even after Arenado was added to the roster, the Brewers are at 494 and the Cardinals are at 478 with what I see right now. I'm still expecting that to change. And my guess is that has to do more with their pitching than anything offensive. And if you look at their pitching projection, it's slightly below the Brewers. And there are questions beyond Jack Flaherty in that rotation. Miles Michaelis, we don't know exactly what he'll look like coming off of an injury. Kwon Hyung Kim, will he be as good as he was for about 9 starts last year? But Nolan Arenado is projected to have 32 homers for them. That's 9 more than anybody else on the team. He's basically projected to be their best slugger, right ahead of Paul Goldschmidt. And I think that that's exactly what we should be expecting out of him. And the defense is just incredible. I mean, you know, I think about in Oakland, Matt Chapman and Matt Olson, and that duo where when they're both healthy, we can pretty much expect them both to win the Gold Glove. I think that you could be seeing that happening in the National League now with Arenado, who's certainly going to win the Gold Glove whenever he's healthy, and Paul Goldschmidt, who's won a few of his own.
Yeah, by the way, Paul DeJong, also pretty good shortstop as well. So, Harrison Bader when he's in center field, Yadier Molina behind the plate, that could be a really good defensive team. The Angels, we knew going into this offseason that their big challenge, again, it feels like we've been saying this for 6 straight years, has been to stabilize the starting rotation. They trade for Alex Cobb. Tell me where you think the Angels are now with their rotation.
Yeah, you know, they keep making these sort of incremental moves and obviously working around the big free agent of the offseason. We saw it last year with not signing Gerrit Cole, who, you know, appeared to have his heart set on New York. That's no fault of the Angels. And now we're seeing the same with Trevor Bauer, rumors that they're out on him. And, you know, we'll see exactly what happens there, but there hasn't been much momentum on that side. So they sign, Jose Quintana, they trade for Alex Cobb. And, you know, Jose Quintana is projected to have a 4.76 ERA this year. Alex Cobb is projected to have a 5.27 ERA. He's one of those, I mean, really you know, bust free agent deals when we talk about that, and just in terms of how his career trajectory has gone. So I personally still don't think it's enough, and projections kind of seem to think the same. The Astros are currently projected to win that division, which their projection changed a lot when they brought back Michael Brantley, which I think really stabilized the offense there. The Angels are projected at a 535 winning percentage. That's higher than what I just told you for the Cardinals and Brewers, but I'm not sure that I see it. I mean, we've seen this team year after year have a really strong offense, especially in 2020. I mean, 16 teams made the postseason in 2020, and the Angels were not able to make the playoffs with Mike Trout, with Anthony Rendon. I know that Ohtani had a down offensive year, but the offense was there and the pitching wasn't, and it just really doesn't seem like it's going to be there this year either.
It feels like the best reason for hope, or one of the best reasons for hope for the Angels, besides a strong offense, is the fact that the rest of the division has taken such a step back.
Yeah.
Like the Oakland Athletics, you know, Marcus Semien leaves, he goes to another team. They haven't gone out and spent this winter. You mentioned the Astros, they lose George Springer. They won't have Justin Verlander at all this year. You know, maybe a start or two at the end of the year, but that might be one that the division becomes like the National League Central, so mediocre that the Angels all of a sudden become a force. Is that reasonable?
Yeah, absolutely. And before the Astros re-signed Michael Brantley, I think the Angels were projected to win the division. And again, I'm not expecting them to be a particularly strong team. I don't think they're a team that would compete in the NL East, which we're expecting to be pretty competitive, or even the AL East. But I think that the weakness and the steps back that those other teams have taken definitely does help the Angels. I just don't know if, I mean, I don't want them to just win the division here. I want Mike Trout in the World Series. This doesn't feel like a team that is going to bring Mike Trout to the World Series. And as an impartial observer who just wants to see the best player play on the absolute biggest stage, I just don't think that they're there yet.
All right, Sarah. Well, always great talking with you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Derek Gould covers the St. Louis Cardinals for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And Derek, Cardinals make one of the big acquisitions of the wintertime, getting Nolan Arenado from the Colorado Rockies with that big long-term deal that he has. It felt like a lot during this winter that they, like a lot of teams, were just kind of laying back. Do you think they were slow playing with uncertainty, or you think they intended at some point to jump in big like this at some point?
I think if Nolan Arenado was available, they wanted to be ready to do it. This has been something that they have talked about, identified, even, you know, I guess focused on, I guess is maybe the right word, targeted. That's the best word. This is a guy who they've wanted to add for years. They thought maybe there was going to be a chance to trade for him going back 2.5 years. Then he signed the long-term extension. They even at one point in time, you know, wondered if this would be the guy that they'd make a play for as a free agent, if they wanted to try to, you know, get into a bidding war for him. Again, he signs a long-term extension. They think, well, that's not going to be possible. A year ago, they talked to the Rockies, see if, you know, if there was a move to be had, if Arenado really wanted out. So I think you go through, you know, they just kind of have always kept him in mind. And then around Thanksgiving, there started to be some movement. And then around December, there seemed to be some retreat. And then around late December, there was some movement. And it's gone back and forth here. And one of the reasons why they probably have been, like you said, slow playing it a little bit, or at least not a huge factor in conversations with other free agents, is because they wanted to be available and ready and not make a move that prohibited them from getting Arenado if and when it became possible. Also, the market allowed for it, to be blunt. You know, I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of move forcing them to make a decision. They could do this. And then when it became a reality and they realized what it might cost them, then they moved on their starting pitcher, which was Adam Wainwright, so that they felt like they could then trade one of their planned starting pitchers in this deal.
How much better do you think Arenado makes the Cardinals? What does he do for them?
Oh, he fills so many needs that they had. He lengthens their lineup. He gives them a middle order hitter. He fits right in with their run prevention style. I mean, you're talking about the best defensive third baseman of his generation. He gives them star power, which they've been lacking. He gives them a swagger. He gives them additional personality, a real jolt of personality. So, I mean, if you talk about on the field, he fits right in with their defense first kind of mentality. He upgrades the team that has been the lowest scoring playoff team in each of the past two seasons, gives them a legit, headline brand name, middle order hitter to put there behind Goldschmidt. So that means that Dylan Carlson has to do less. That means that Paul DeJong doesn't have to be the cleanup hitter. It lightens the load on everyone else in the lineup because that guy's there. And then just from like a bigger picture, it gives a bit of the Cardinal confidence back. I mean, look, you know, this is a team that's been turned down here quite a bit recently. I mean, you think about the players that they've tried to get who have gone elsewhere. Paul Goldschmidt changed that tune a little bit, but they still smart from Stanton saying no. They still smart from David Price going elsewhere. Ownership still at one point in time reminded John Mozeliak, the president of baseball operations, that they're pretty tired of being the phrase they used was they're pretty tired of being the bridesmaid, the runner up for some of these guys. They wanted to land a star. And, you know, ownership had long thought that this guy would be a great fit for the style of team and the style of ball club and just the whole Cardinal aesthetic that Arenado would be a great fit for that. And now they got him.
How good were the prospects that they gave up in this deal? There was a volume of prospects, but whenever I see that, I'm sure you do too at this point, after covering baseball for a lot of years, you're like, okay, sometimes teams just ask for extra guys to dress up a trade.
Yeah. They're playing the odds game, right? Like they think, okay, well, if we get, the Rockies kind of explained this in their press conference, was they felt that a few of these guys were the equivalent of the compensation pick. So might as well get a few to see if one emerges, or get a few to see if two emerge. That way they're ahead of the game because then they got more talent than a compensation pick. Austin Gomber, I think is a strong pitcher. What he has become in the last few years, I think he would have made it very difficult for the Cardinals not to have him in the rotation. He could have gone into spring training and outpitched Carlos Martinez or any of these other guys and won a spot in the rotation. He has that kind of ability. He's got that kind of determinedness. And I think he's a good fit in a lot of ways for sort of the mentality that you talk about a pitcher has to have there at Coors Field. Lefty, he's got some bite to him. So I think he's going to be, even, you know, yesterday in the Rockies press conference, they wouldn't commit to the role he has. It sounded a little bit like they're not quite sure what they have in him. They have a good major league pitcher in him. I'm intrigued by Mateo Gil. Mateo Gil is a reliable middle infielder, shortstop now, could be a guy whose bat works at second base. Could stay at shortstop as a reliable fielder there. Benji Gill's son. So he's got a real savvy, beyond his age view of baseball. And that includes an understanding of what it means to be a utility player and not play all that time. And that can help a young guy get to the majors. And then you've seen that happen with the Rockies before, where a guy arrives as a utility and then sticks around and starts playing. Some of the other players, Montero, a legit bat, could be, you know, a real strong force coming back from injury, a real difficult season. It would not surprise me, Buster, if four of those guys reach the majors and contribute in some way. Not saying that they last long. I mean, you think Montero, if his bat plays, if he gets healthy, he'll contribute. Austin Gomber is going to be a factor for them no matter what. And then you think Gil could get there, and we'll see what opening is allowed for him. But I think four of those five guys could at least get to the majors, which isn't too bad in a deal like this. It's just not going to, they're just going to have to earn their status as names people know, which is probably in the long run best for prospects, right? Everybody dreams on them. Let these guys go and prove it.
When you said that, you mentioned Gil, I covered his dad. Mm-hmm. I covered Benji Gil in high school at Castle Park High School in San Diego when he was playing high school ball. That makes me feel pretty old.
Yeah.
I know.
Mateo's 20, if that helps.
I talked to a lot of executives of other teams. They thought this trade was incomprehensibly bad for the Rockies.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't understand why the Rockies didn't simply wait to the end of 2021 and for Arenado to reach the point where he could potentially opt out of the deal and wait for a decision. In fact, I had one executive say to me, shoot, I would have gone to him beginning of this offseason and said, Nolan, you want to opt out? You can opt out right now as far as we're concerned. Make that public. You know, have Arenado say, no, I'm not opting out. And that takes the pressure off the team. And the public relation plays out very differently. What was your sense of people you talked to about how this deal was, especially with the Rockies kicking in, you know, $50+ million?
Yeah, my kind of, I don't know if that was the right word here. My relationship with this deal is pretty much as long as the Cardinals have. I mean, you know, I was looking back and writing that this was something that they wanted to pull off back in, I guess, December 2018. And, you know, a year ago, I did the story just about like just how difficult it was for them to pull off this trade because of all the things that we saw, the opt-outs, the money, the single season salary, this $35 million that he was owed in these seasons. There just were so many elements to it. And then of course the big part, which is what you asked, the PR aspect. And one of the points that I try to make, and I apologize if I did so on the show with you before, is that at some point in time, Arenado had to force this issue, that's where Colorado was at, that from a standpoint, they could under the, you know, and they kind of talked about this too, is they could under the radar kind of check what the market was going to be like, kind of understand what their return would be. They can talk to the Cardinals, ask for a high return, which they did, ask them to take on all the salary, which they did, but they could just get information in that regard. And then when this would really move forward is when Arenado said, I want out. And then they could shift the PR conversation to, well, hey, we did everything we could to keep the guy. This guy wants out. And there does seem to be an element that they were betting on the fact that he would opt out and that they would only be left with a compensation pick. But then, you know, we've seen this play out. You know, what we were talking about in baseball 12 months ago was a lot different than what we're talking about in baseball right now.
Yeah.
Because of a pandemic, because of economics, just because, I mean, just the whole world is different. Obviously, I'm not saying anything, you know, news breaking there. And there's an element there where the Rockies are like, oof, you know, what happens this year? What could happen this year? A season cut in half, you know, some kind of work stoppage ahead of the CBA being, you know, expiring, what could happen, all the things that could happen where he goes, you know what, I'm not comfortable opting out. And then they're stuck.
But if the alternative is to give up $50 million, yeah. You know, it may have been better for them.
I mean,
it may have been better for the franchise just for him to walk away as opposed to, and then the PR stuff is like, well, no, that was Nolan's decision. Where yeah. Now it feels like they're getting the worst of both worlds. Right?
Yeah, I like that idea of going to ask him to opt out. But oof, you know, I mean that you know, then he gets the choice. That would be a big play, you know, for the team. I don't know how the union would react to that. You would know better than I. If a team just went to a guy and said, "Hey, look, you know, you can opt out now," especially in the middle of this market. I mean, the union right. might have an issue with that because of the present day value of his contract and what precedent that would set.
Yeah, there was a lot of interesting ideas from other teams. Real quick, 30 seconds, Cardinals clear favorites to win the Central now, yes?
Yeah, I think they were probably favorites by an edge beforehand, given that the NL Central took the winner off and decided to, they're a week ago, week and a half ago, the biggest deal in the Central had been the Wainwright deal. And that was more money spent on free agents than the other four teams combined. So
they kind of
hibernated. Well, that's not true because they were very busy getting rid of talent, not acquiring talent. So, the Cardinals pitching this time of year, follow the pitching, but it's hard not to take a look at that lineup and have a fresh look at what kind of offense the Cardinals could have and just what kind of just like, energy they could have around them. I mean, this is a guy who brings buoyancy to a team. You've seen it in Colorado, and you know you're probably going to see it even more so in St. Louis, where he's been, you know, freed of so many of the frustrations. He's going to play with one of his good friends. They're going to have the best cornermen probably in the National League when you think about third base and first base. And then they always have the pitching that elevated them likely to the favorite anyways.
All right, Derek, thanks for doing this, even though you had a Mizzou hat on. Go away.
I wore it all for you there. There you go. M-I-Z.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Wednesday. We got a pair of tweets here. First up, James Shanahan at Shanny STL. He writes in, is Scott Rolen gaining momentum in the Hall of Fame voting? Does he go in wearing the Phillies cap or the Cardinals cap?
Shanny, I would say, look, if the decision was only going to be made by the Hall of Fame that he'd going in with a Phillies cap, he was drafted by the Phillies. His first 7 years in the big leagues were with the Phillies. He spent 6 years with the Cardinals. So he literally had more time in the Philadelphia organization. But I also feel like that this is a situation where it's close enough where the Hall of Fame will get input from Roland and say, look, it's kind of a coin flip. Do you have a specific preference? Of course, the Hall of Fame, I want to say, what was it, 20 years ago, basically took the right to choose the cap out of the hands of the player because they were worried about players marketing that right and making deals based on that right to put the cap on the plaque.
Interesting nugget there. Last one for today. Our pal Cameron Black at blind_QB writes in, "Hello, Buster. Hope you are healthy and well." So nice of you, Cameron. Yep. "I live in Kansas City and am a big Royals fan. Other than my love for the team, please give me a reason to listen to and be excited about Royals baseball this season."
Okay, they didn't go all in the way that the Padres did, or, you know, they didn't spend as much as the White Sox did. I will say, I think the Royals are getting better. And I thought the addition of Carlos Santana was good at this time because they do have a nice core of young players. Santana has good at-bats, and he's someone who can stabilize that lineup. He'll draw walks. They made some other moves around the edges. I think they're going to be better this year. And keep in mind, it looks like the Indians are probably going to take a step back. Having traded Lindor, the White Sox and the Twins are probably going to be the two teams the Royals are going to chase. But as a Royals fan, I think you have to feel good about the fact that the team is making incremental progress.
All right. There you go, Cameron. Thanks for writing in, everyone. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And please subscribe to, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts.
That's it for today. My thanks to Derek, to Jeff, to Sarah, to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.